Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Hello and welcome to the Leaders Toolbox here on Radio at Firehouse.com. Today we are here with host Richard Gassaway and a very special guest, the chief of the Minneapolis Fire Department, who was part of the leadership team for a major catastrophe that occurred last week. So thank you for joining us today, Chief Gassaway and Chief Clay.
Welcome to the Leaders Toolbox. It's a special privilege for us today to be in downtown Minneapolis with Chief Jim Clack of the Minneapolis Fire Department. For listeners and readers of Firehouse.com, you know that Minneapolis was vaulted into the national spotlight with a major thoroughfare bridge collapse that occurred on August 1st, 2007. We're fortunate that Chief Clack has taken some time from his busy schedule to sit with us and to give us an opportunity in the fire service to learn firsthand from the chief of the fire department how the incident went, how things unfolded, and maybe if it's soon enough, some lessons that they've been able to glean from this major catastrophic event that really could strike any city in America. So welcome, Chief Clack.
Thank you, Rich.
Why don't you start out by just taking it right from the beginning as to when the incident occurred and how you came to know about it, the kind of response that you sent, the things that you found, and how it progressed.
Well, this was Wednesday night last week, about a little after 6 p.m. I was on the way home, actually, with my daughter in my response vehicle and heard the initial radar reports. Initially, I thought it was probably just a small section or maybe a guardrail that had fallen off the bridge. I knew it was under construction, some construction going on there, and it didn't sound like from the initial reports that it was a big deal. That changed rather quickly when the first arriving units got there and talked about the entire bridge being in the river, and of course I responded right away, gave my daughter quite a ride down to the scene. When I arrived about 30 minutes later, I was up on the 10th Avenue Bridge, which is just south of the site, just a couple hundred feet. And my initial impression was that this was almost an unbelievable scene. There was people crawling all over the rubble. We had established a command post on the 10th Avenue Bridge. And I just took a minute to take in what was going on, then went down to the command post, checked in with the on-scene incident commander, which at that time was our duty deputy chief, Christensen, Richard Christensen, who was doing an outstanding job of trying to organize chaos. I soon found Assistant Chief Friedel, who took over incident command or operations, really, at the scene from Chief Christensen, and started getting things organized. I left the scene almost immediately and came down to City Hall to report to the EOC. We've got an Emergency Operations Center here in City Hall, and I wanted to make sure that was up and running and that people knew I was here and we had all the right people responding in. Once that was done, I went back to the scene, and remarkably, we had pretty much got things organized, got some staging areas set up, got the rescue effort organized. The access to the scene was tremendously difficult initially because we only had two sides of this bridge, and it was very tough getting down to the river with no access. So responders did a great job of improvising. There were some pickups used to transport patients. We got plenty of backboards down on the scene immediately. And a combination of firefighters, police officers, and others evacuated the entire bridge and transported over 50 people, injured people, within the first 2 hours. And so I thought that was amazing. That work was all done by first responders and citizens and cops, and it was a miracle in progress. I couldn't imagine when I first pulled up on that scene that we would have that few number of fatalities and injuries. I thought it would be in the dozens, and it turned out that the news was much better than that.
Incredible. What kind of resources, as far as the fire department, Minneapolis Fire Department response, what kind of resources did they have on the scene working the incident?
Well, we had 26 fire trucks. That's our normal complement during the day. The initial incident commander asked for all available units to respond to the scene. I modified that order via phone within a minute after hearing it, because I knew that no matter how big this scene was, we still have a city of almost 400,000 people to protect. And so I asked the dispatcher to keep one engine in each fire district, a total of four crews, out of the scene, which was tremendously disappointing to those firefighters. But I thought it was important that we maintain some coverage until we could get some mutual aid help into the city. So we sent 22 of our 26 on-duty crews to the scene within the first couple of minutes.
Wow, incredible. The fire department mutual aid component, how was that implemented, and how did that play into assisting on the incident?
Well, the mutual aid system we had set up and agreements set up worked great. We have automatic aid with one suburb, that's Richfield, and we have a mutual aid agreement with our sister city, St. Paul, that we use quite a bit just for normal day-to-day operations. Those two agreements allowed us to get those folks on the way almost immediately. In addition, we got a Deputy Chief Gene Kidd, down into the communication center and started calling our mutual aid partners and asking them both to respond to the scene and backfill into our fire stations. And so Chief Kidd did a great job of ordering resources to make sure we maintained coverage and got what we needed at the scene. It turned out, because of the amount of time it took, the quick rescue effort, that we really didn't need all of the resources that ended up coming to the scene. And so that part was good, and I think our mutual aid system worked out very well. We've got mutual aid agreements with the North Suburban Mutual Aid Association, which is over 40 departments, and also Southwest, which is another several departments that we can call upon when we have a big emergency. And developing those relationships with those chiefs and those associations before this incident, I think, was key to making it work very well.
Do you have an idea of how many or what types of emergency calls you handled while the bridge incident was going on? You know, what other things were happening in the city, realizing it doesn't just stand still while your companies are working at a bridge incident? What kind of other things were going on in the city?
That evening, we were fortunate we didn't have any working structure fires during this incident, and that was my biggest concern, is that we would have crews trying to operate a structure fire without enough help while this was going on. We had several emergency calls and several false alarms that were handled by the on-duty crews. So they were busy. The ones that weren't at the scene were very busy running around taking care of the normal business.
Okay. And I know that Hennepin County, including Minneapolis, just within the recent past 2 or 3 years, had transitioned to 800 megahertz radio communications, and then Ramsey County, even more recently, had converted to 800 megahertz. And the big one of the big pushes for 800 megahertz radio is interoperability, where multiple agencies can coordinate and communicate with each other. Maybe you could share with us some about how the 800 megahertz system stood up to this test with the amount of traffic there was, and then maybe some of the ways that that interoperability maybe contributed to the success of the incident.
Well, the 800 megahertz system is relatively new to the Minneapolis and the surrounding area, and it was key to our ability to communicate. In any major incident, and in this incident as well, we'll have some learning to do about how communications worked and didn't work. I know initially we had some issues with cell phone coverage, which is seems like it's always the case when everybody's trying to get on the same tower. But we were able to work around those. Our radio coverage was flawless. It worked very well. We could assign working groups to different channels. We were able to cross-patch different agencies together that needed to be together. And so all of those capabilities, being able to communicate with everybody on the scene through a common radio system, was critical to our success here.
Good. That's wonderful to hear. And being one of the responders, I can say that that was one of the things that stood out, was the coordination of communications. Chief Clack, what were some of the, if you wanted to frame up for listeners in a way that they could understand the complexity of this incident, because there were a lot of things happening. It wasn't, you know, just some cars in the water. There were a lot of other variables that were making this complicated fire and rescue scene. So if you could, maybe share some of those things that really added to the complexity of the incident.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, you know, when you drop an 8-lane freeway into the river, you've got dozens of cars that either rode the bridge spans down or ended up in the river. But beyond that, we had a train underneath the bridge that was impacted, and several train cars smashed and leaking unknown product onto the ground. We had we know that there was people living under the bridge at various times. We know that we had traffic, barge traffic, and other river traffic moving up and down the river. We didn't know if there was some of those issues under the bridge. We later heard that there was a major river boat that just missed being involved in this. The incident scene actually is just downriver from a lock. And of course, all the lock operations were impacted. We had just the complexity of coordinating all the different responding agencies, not only fire, Minneapolis Fire and all of our mutual aid partners, but police and all of their mutual aid partners, and the Red Cross and the state assets, the Highway Patrol, and all of these dive teams coming in from different sheriff's departments and wanting to help, and media helicopters and media and trying to figure out where to stage media almost immediately. It was a very complicated operation, and it was organized chaos, believe it or not. We had practiced with most of these folks this type of large-scale incident. I knew all of the players, the people heading these agencies, and I had a relationship with them, and I had phone numbers, and so we were able to kind of coordinate the chaos almost from the beginning, which was amazing to me. You train for these incidents. You do tabletops, you go to training, you take NIMS training, and you run everybody through it, and you think, well, we've practiced this and we've done these scenarios and it worked okay and we've got some lessons learned, but if this happens, will it come together? And in this case, it did happen and it did come together, which is very reassuring, gives us a lot of confidence that if the next event happens next week or next year, we'll be ready.
Mm-hmm. Good. maybe share with us some about how the unified command post was organized, maybe some of the representatives that were operating together in there, some of the interactions they may have had, some of the joint challenges that they may have worked on that were, you know, between police and fire and other agencies, and how that went.
Well, initially, fire was the incident commander in the operation center, or the command center down by the river. And we've got a real good agreement here in the Twin Cities where whoever the lead agency is in the incident, whatever's going on in the incident that's the most important function, that's going to be the lead agency. So, of course, the first 28 hours or so, that was fire, because the first focus was on rescuing everybody that was savable. And so I, as the incident commander, and all of the fire chiefs that work for me in operations and logistics and safety and even in finance, believe it or not, we were working on documenting the event. All were working together to make sure that what we were doing was going to be successful. And all these other agencies, the police chief, the sheriff, medical, the local hospitals, were all working to support what we were doing. And that changed. It changed within 28 hours. I passed command to the police chief because the incident changed. It changed from a rescue operation where we had saved everybody that we thought was savable into more of a security and a search operation, which is the strength of the sheriff's department. And so I passed command to law enforcement, and we became support to them. What I was amazed with here, and I shouldn't have been amazed because I know the individuals involved, there was no egos, there was no this is I'm in charge kind of stuff going on. It was what is going on at the scene, who can best do it, and that agency take the lead and we'll all support. And that was true not only in public safety, but in EMS, in Red Cross, and in all the other agencies that came in to support us. Everybody was there. Public Works did a great job here, getting whatever we needed as quick as they could get it. And so it went very well. It was very integrated and very cooperative down there at that Unified Command Center.
Excellent. What are some lessons learned? And I know it's kind of early maybe to have this discussion because the dust is really kind of just settling on the incident, and there's probably even yet had the opportunity to conduct a debriefing or a critique of the incident. But I would assume that within the hours and days after, you've had the opportunity to talk to some of your key command personnel who operated at the scene and captured some of those lessons. Even though we had a wonderful outcome here, and some of the things that you've discussed paint the picture that the importance of being prepared and having relationships built and having people ready for a large-scale incident, there's always some takeaways, some things you can say, you know, if I had the chance to have to do an incident like this again, we could even do even better if we did some things in different ways. Are any of those lessons surfaced yet?
Well, I'll tell you, on Monday we had our top management team meeting, actually as this was just starting to settle down. And I asked all the division chiefs to start recording all of the lessons that they have learned even as they're working and start capturing that stuff. We designated somebody to collate all of this information as it comes in from, you know, a dozen different chiefs that were working in different areas within the incident. And so Chief Kidd is going to take all of that information and boil it down into discussion points. When we've already set a meeting for about 10 days from now where we're going to sit down and take several hours and go through each one of those lessons and talk about them, and then assign that work, if we figure there's work to be done in that area, to somebody to follow up on and develop either policy, procedure, relationships, whatever it is we need to do to make us even better. I want to stress that I think this has went extremely well. And part of the issue with doing after-action critiques after a big incident is you don't want to get into finger-pointing and you don't want to drag people down. And I think that we're doing it the right way and that we're capturing this stuff individually, and then we'll come together, close the door, and talk about what we saw and what we could do better next time as an organization, not as individuals. And I think that'll work well. It'll remain to be seen. Having said that, I know initially we've got a few issues that we're going to have to work through before next time. One is this cell phone idea. We have cell phones, all the command staff, and actually I bought cell phones for all the fire trucks last year. They're one particular cell provider. And what we found was it was helpful to have more than one cell phone provider working within your agency. And so I have another provider that I carry two cell phones, so does our command vehicle, but the rest of our staff only has one cell access. And we're going to work to get more than one available, at least to the key chief officers. So that was one learning. Secondly, we need to do a better job of figuring out how to organize the people coming back in from off-duty. The last big incident we had here in Minneapolis was in 1982 when we burned a great big bank building, high-rise fire downtown. And one of the learnings from that that I remember learning way back when I was first on the fire department was that you can't call everybody back at once because then you don't have anybody to do the work, you know, 24 and 48 hours out. And we didn't do that here. We didn't call everybody back, but we had a lot of people coming in to fire stations and to the scene that didn't have a vehicle to respond with. Our firefighters were going to their station to pick up their equipment, and there was no car or truck or anything to move them around, so they felt a little bit helpless. So we're going to have to work out the logistics of how we integrate people coming back in a big emergency into our system, and so that they can be useful to us quicker. Believe it or not, we want to get even quicker, and we were organized within 2 hours where we had everybody on vehicles, but we want to get quicker than that. And so that's another learning. And there's several more. A lot of them I call tweaks. They're not big learning, but they're things that we just need to keep working around the edges and keep getting better.
Mm-hmm. Now, Minneapolis is a large department, so I would let me make an assumption, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that there probably isn't, in the course of normal operations, very many opportunities to call your off-duty people back into work for an emergency. Is that a reasonable guess? So that's not something you guys do a lot?
No, it isn't. We very rarely actually have to call in off-duty firefighters.
And when you do, for like this incident, when you call them in, I'm envisioning that there's somebody with a telephone list that picks up and makes a phone call and then makes another phone call. Is that how it's done?
Yes, we've got callback lists in every fire station. And so that was another reason, by the way, I didn't want all 26 crews going to the scene, because part of our callback system is being able to utilize the firefighters that are not responding to the scene to do these callbacks for us. We are working on doing a reverse 911 system or a reverse 311 system and loading in all of our firefighters' information, and so that we can allow technology to do these callbacks. Part of that's going to have to be integrating where we want them to go. Because if it's not a live person saying, hey, go to station 21 and man, you know, spare ladder 4, we're going to have to figure out how to make that work with new technology. But we're committed to doing that. One of the other things we want to do is get a new emergency operations center. And alongside that emergency operations center, instead of having our spare apparatus scattered throughout the city, we want to have a central location with spare apparatus in one location under one big roof, with all fully equipped with turnout gear there, so that we can have all of our off-duty firefighters go to that one location and be dispatched from there. That's how we envision trying to solve part of this problem of how you get off-duty firefighters in service as quickly as possible.
Now, is that a solution that was kind of derived from talking internally, or do you guys have is there a model out there of a place that you know that's doing that kind of staging of their spare equipment now? Is there another city that is doing something like that, or is that a creation that you guys have come up with as a result of talking about this incident?
I don't know of another department that's trying to do what we're talking about here. We've actually been talking about doing that for several years, and we've got funding now to build our emergency operations center right next to our training center just north of Minneapolis. And that's part of what we're going to integrate into that. And so we've got all of this stuff in one place.
So then your callback folks would then respond to there.
Right.
They'll have spare gear and apparatus, and then they could take that apparatus and either take it to a station to kind of backfill it, or come out to the scene of the emergency, depending on what the command would want them to do.
Correct. And then on the flip side of that, maybe the incident isn't in Minneapolis. Earlier this spring, we got called to the North Shore to go up and help with a wildfire, and we sent a couple of structural engines up there. And for calls from outside our agency for mutual aid, we would also utilize that central place to bring together the crews that are going to respond and dispatch them from there instead of trying to take on-duty crews and send them and then backfill. We'll use our staging area by our training facility to send people out. We're getting more and more missions outside the city with our heavy rescue capability, with our hazmat capability, and quite frankly, because we're one of the few departments that have a large number of on-duty firefighters all the time working, we're getting more and more work outside the city, which we're happy to do, and we're happy to gain the experience and help out, but we need to just better organize that.
Now, you talked about the size of your department and the number you have on duty, and that's one detail that I think that some people would be interested in knowing that probably didn't come out in the media. What was your working strength that day as far as personnel on duty?
Well, we were at 96, which is our normal working strength every day. 96 firefighters working below the rank of battalion chief, so we've got 96 captains, FMOs, or drivers, and firefighters working, along with four battalion chiefs and an on-duty deputy chief. That's our 24-hour staffing for the city. So 101 sworn firefighters work every day.
Okay. From the perspective of dispatch, Minneapolis has their own dispatch center. Hennepin County has a dispatch center that provides dispatch services for the majority of the other fire and police agencies in Hennepin County, but Minneapolis has their own dispatch for them. How do things work from your perspective as far as the coordination between the scene and dispatch? And I would assume the dispatch, the phones were probably lighting up like Christmas trees as people were reporting not only the incident, but lost loved ones and concerns, and I would guess it was pretty chaotic there. Do you have any sense as to how things went in dispatch?
Well, I know they're also entering into their own after-action report process and learning process, but it just in initial discussions with the director of the Emergency Communications Center, one of the challenges they had is calls coming in from firefighters and others right to the dispatch center, to the dispatchers themselves, asking about where to report or what was needed. And that was several hundred calls in the first couple of hours. So they're going to need to figure out a system of triage for those calls and get some people that have some good knowledge about what we're doing to be able to answer those calls rather than having the dispatchers do that. Again, normal day-to-day operations, structure fire, second, third alarm structure fire, there's not a problem with a half a dozen calls coming into MECC, into our communication center, asking questions. But when you get several hundred, it gets to be a distraction and gets to be too much to handle. So that's one of their learnings, and we're going to support them in figuring out a solution to that.
With the companies that you had working, the complexity of the incident being kind of divided between what happened on the North Shore, what was happening in the river, and what was happening on the South Shore, and some of your firefighters who had come back to work, got their gear, come to the scene. Were you challenged at all with accountability, say, within the first couple hours of the incident? From being at the scene, I was amazed at the amount of responders and then also wondering how all of those folks who were very active and moving about and working could be accounted for. Was that a challenge for you?
Absolutely. In the first hour or two of the incident, there was responders working, both on-duty and off-duty Minneapolis folks, but also people from other agencies. I think in overall, the fire service responders were very good about checking in after the initial wave with our staging area and getting assignments and working in divisions and groups rather than freelancing. Of course, initially, before there was a command structure there and everybody was trying to do their best to do whatever they could to help, I think there was a lot of lack of accountability initially. But I really credit the folks working there on the scene and getting that under control relatively quickly. And we knew within a short amount of time who was working and who they were working for and what their mission was. You know, initially we were focused on getting people off the bridge into the hospital. But once that was done, once we found everybody we could find initially, the incident commander did something I think was very good and something that I heard that came out of Oklahoma City, and that was to back everybody out and then re-engage so that we could gain full accountability of everybody there and gain accountability and security of the scene. So that happened at some point after a few hours. We backed everybody out, got the USAR teams, the people that were trained to be in this rubble, as well as some structural engineers and bridge engineers and folks that could tell us what their opinion was of the scene and the scene safety. Once that happened, we had good accountability. Initially, it was a difficult task to figure out who was doing what and where and who was there.
Mm-hmm. Incident command structure, layout for us. I know it's tough to do without a visual to look at, but in the unified command, you had somebody in charge of fire forces in the unified command. But beyond that, then where were your key components of your fire incident chart? What were those positions? What would that look like?
Okay. Well, initially, I was the incident commander, not on the scene. Which is interesting when you don't have a visual. I had very little visual contact with the actual scene. All of my contact was by radio and phone because I was either here at the EOC, which initially, by the way, didn't have video connections to the scene, and that was established later on where we could actually see both ends of the bridge from the EOC. Another learning, by the way, is to get that up sooner. We even had difficulty with the TV, which is, CNN's a great intelligence resource, and we didn't have a TV down there initially to get those helicopter shots. But anyway, we divided the incident into a north and south command. We had a USAR team working in both ends, and once we were able to back people off the bridge and then re-engage them, we had good control of both ends. There was somebody in charge of both ends of the bridge. We had a couple people in charge of staging, one chief officer from a responding agency that was a suburb, actually, was in charge of one staging area, and we had another one of our chiefs in charge of the other. And so we got control of that. Logistics was actually co-located with the EOC downtown here. Safety was out at the scene, and another chief officer took that role. Finance was in the EOC almost right away, documenting what we were doing. So we had things broke down, but we weren't all together. We weren't even in visual contact with each other most of the time. It was more a lot of cell phone, a lot of radio connections between the different functions within the ICS system, which worked good because we know each other well enough to know what each other's doing. So we didn't need to keep reaffirming with each other that things were getting done. We had some great people staffing all those functions and making sure that they got help. In some cases, staging and operations and logistics were all different agencies working in the same system, and that worked well. So it was a very difficult incident to get your hands around, at least initially, and having good people doing what they've been trained to do to a high level was the key.
Were there any injuries of any of responders?
I just learned of two more injuries today. We've had a total of 6 injuries to firefighters, all of them minor, with the exception of one of them today I heard was maybe a hernia, possible hernia. But all the rest of them were cuts, bruises, sprains, that kind of thing. Again, very successful for the scope of the operation, the dangerous nature of the incident scene. It was a very successful operation from the standpoint of injuries, and it continues even today to be a concern of mine that we're maintaining that safety focus on the scene. And I know John Friedel, my operations assistant chief, is constantly after people there to wear their helmets, gloves, their PPE, if they're operating anywhere in the hot zone. And so we're maintaining that. I don't want to get anybody hurt a week after the incident because we're not vigilant about safety. There's nobody left to save there. We need to be deliberate and keep safety in mind, keep command and control in mind, know what everybody's doing within the hot zone. If they don't have a job in the hot zone, get them out of there. And all of those things that we do initially because we're amped up, we need to maintain that as things settle down and as they have been settling down over the past week, to always keep in mind that we need to keep people safe no matter who they are if they're within this hot zone.
Excellent.
This incident very quickly was vaulted into national and international media. And there was lots of media on the scene, lots of feeds to national media. Did that present any challenges for the fire department or the operations to have that amount of media so early on into the incident?
It's always a challenge when you get so many people interested in getting the story. I have to credit our communications department here at the City of Minneapolis for quickly organizing that and getting out information about when we were going to do these initial press briefings, and also phone numbers to call for the media to call to coordinate interviews and press briefing times and locations, and all of that was done for us. And so I was able to say, you know, we probably can't give them any more information for 3 more hours. And they would set a time 3 hours out, find a good location, and then just relay to me where to be. Same with the elected officials and the other leaders of public safety agencies. So that part went very well. It became, especially as the rescue efforts subsided and the police took a more lead role in this recovery, and the sheriff's department, it became more my job to talk to the media and let those guys do the operations. And so as I passed command, then I became more of a face in the media for Friday, Saturday, Sunday. To be able to update people, I would go to the command post, listen to the briefings, listen to the plans, listen to what had been happening, and then go and stand in front of the media and tell them what I could tell them about what was going on. And so again, we did this kind of rotation of people that were assigned to kind of keep the story out and people that could actually work and not be distracted by that.
Well, you probably didn't have much opportunity to be watching television, but after the incident went into recovery mode and the mutual aid departments were sent home, I had the chance to watch the major news networks, and if it hadn't come to you yet, I can tell you that the Minneapolis Fire Department praises were being sung on all the major networks, CNN, Fox News, especially. They had some, as media tends to do, have some experts on to kind of critique and analyze things, and the rescue efforts and the coordination of the event was a consistent message in the media as to how impressive that was and how significant role that was in the successful outcome. So media has a tendency to not be particularly kind when catastrophe happens, as they're looking to sometimes appear to find the worst stories to tell for whatever reason. But if there was criticism to be passed in the days that followed, that criticism was not pointed toward the rescue operations and the work of the responders. So that was a very very heartening to me to see that the media was able to see, and the experts that they brought in were able to see the amount of preparation and planning pay off in how you guys responded to this. In closing, I think what I'd like to ask of you is, do you have any advice? Now, out there listening are fire chiefs and chief fire officers and commanders from fire departments all over America, from communities ranging to from a couple thousand people to hundreds of thousands of people, all of which have one thing in common with Minneapolis: they have bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And there isn't any of us who haven't been watching the media that knows nationally the attention is drawn toward bridge safety. And all the media in different states are talking about how many bridges in their states are structurally deficient or have similar issues that perhaps this bridge had or didn't have. And so the awareness is all heightened that if it can happen in Minneapolis, Minnesota, it can happen anywhere. So from your perspective of the fire chief, for the rest of us out there who might be worried that something like that could happen in our community, give us some advice.
Well, you know, we don't, as a fire service, have primary responsibility for bridges, of course, just like we don't have responsibility for a lot of things that goes on in our jurisdictions. But I would say, and one of the things that it was very tempting for me, and I don't think I stepped on this landmine, is don't try and be an expert at something you don't know a lot about. I got media questions right away. Well, Chief, what happened? What happened to this bridge? What do you think happened? What might have happened? And my answer was, I'm not an engineer. I'm a fire chief. I can tell you about what we did for rescue. I don't know what happened to the bridge. It's very tempting to say or speculate. Maybe you hear an expert at a briefing or something talk about what could have happened, and to pass that kind of information on is a mistake. Because we need to be specialists in what we do. We need to be good at what we do and leave all the rest of the stuff to other people that are better than us at that profession. And so don't try and get into an area where you're not an expert. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know, that's not my specialty. I don't know how many people are injured. I don't know how many people are killed yet. We've got some preliminary numbers. There's several. Using terms like several or more vague instead of being absolute with anything, because that gets you in trouble. I know initially we were getting reports from the scene that seven people had passed away. That got revised downward, and now it's creeping back up. And so those numbers are always going to jump around in an incident like this, and it's really important for the families and for our own profession that we not be seen as having bad information or passing out bad information.
As responders, what advice could you give us as to how we could be best prepared to handle an incident of this magnitude, or even some scaled down version of an incident of this magnitude for maybe more suburban or rural America that could find themselves facing this? As you know, what could we learn from your experience here that would be beneficial for us?
Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of things that went into getting ready for an incident like this that we never imagined we'd even have to use, from keeping ourselves in physically good shape, taking advantage of education, not only fire service education, but just having a well-rounded education. One of the things we're doing here is encouraging people to go to school and learn something. It doesn't even have to be about the fire service. Something about the world around us, absorbing information, read trade journals like Firehouse and others, that where you're learning other people's experience so you don't repeat it. All of those, and training and preparing and having plans and SOPs and practicing them and tweaking them, and all of those things leading up to an incident or what make it go successfully. If you don't educate yourself, if you don't keep yourself in physically good shape, and you don't know what's going on in the fire service and in other professions, you're putting yourself behind the curve when you're going to face something like this. It's really important to be prepared in all those ways. Be personally prepared. One of the things the Red Cross is emphasizing after this incident is we all need to have our own personal emergency preparedness plan for us and our families. And being personally prepared, keeping ourselves fit, keeping ourselves engaged mentally, physically, in our profession is key to being successful down the road when anyone is faced with a large or small incident. All of those things play into how successful we are.
Good. Well, on behalf of the nation's fire service, I want to thank you for taking time. This incident isn't even 7 days old yet, and you're taking time to sit down with us and share your thoughts, and that's going to be very valuable to the fire service. It speaks volumes for your commitment to seeing that the fire service is well informed and learning the lessons from what happened here. My hat's off to the Minneapolis police and fire departments and all the responders throughout the region who contributed to the success of this. I think that there's going to be some nice after-action reports that come out that's going to talk about the lessons, but I think it's also going to highlight a number of very good lessons that come from this based on some of the things that you talked about with being prepared and practiced and trained and educated. So for that, I appreciate it. So for the listeners, if you're interested in learning more about this, keep your eyes out for information that's going to be coming out in the trade journals and the after-action reports, and learn everything that you can from this incident that was probably close to as model incident as we've come in recent years of a catastrophe of this magnitude. Again, Chief Clack, thank you for sitting down with us and spending some time with us this afternoon, and thanks to the listeners for tuning in to the Leader's Toolbox.
Thank you, Rich.
Okay, Chief Gassway, thank you very much. What a wonderful interview. Chief Clack, thank you for joining us. Many lessons to be learned, and it seems that everything went as planned. For anybody who thinks that incident management doesn't work and any of the naysayers out there, I think this is definitely an opportunity to say it does work when you do train with it and you do use it on a daily basis. So thank you. Rich, is there anything coming up? I know the International Association of Fire Chiefs Conference is coming up, and we have our conference later in the year, but is there anything coming up soon that firefighters from across the country will have a firsthand opportunity to listen to somebody present?
There is, Pete. I've been in contact with the Program Planning Committee for Fire Rescue International that's going to be in Atlanta this month. And I'm pleased to report on August 23rd, which is a Thursday, from 3:30 to 5 p.m. at Fire Rescue International in Atlanta, myself and some representatives from Minneapolis Fire Department will be conducting a session to talk about the bridge incident. And that'll be the first face-to-face, in-person opportunity for members of the fire service to come together with people who were involved in the incident and hear a presentation and to ask questions. So we're looking for a pretty good turnout, and hoping that people will that come to FRI will come and see us on that Thursday and learn firsthand from talking with the officials from Minneapolis and then myself as a mutual aid responder as to how the event unfolded.
All right, great. Well, we look forward to seeing you then. I'll make sure I stop into that. That's, again, Thursday at 3:30 at the Fire Rescue International Atlanta. All right, Chief. Well, thank you very much. For our listeners, as always, thank you for joining us on this program. And if you do have any questions or comments, please feel free to send us an email at podcast@firehouse.com. Thank you, Chief. We'll see you again next month.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.